Good morning. My name is Frank Dravis, and you are listening to WDRT Conversations, 91.9 FM in Viroqua. Today, my guest is Emily Berge, Democratic candidate for the U.S. Congressional District of Wisconsin. Good morning, Emily.
Good morning, Frank.
How are you doing?
I'm doing really great. It's a beautiful morning this morning.
It is. It's a great morning. It's good to have you at our station again, mm-hmm. Emily. The last time we spoke was back in October, and it was on day 20 of the full government shutdown. And at that time, we thought that was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
So much has happened since then.
Yeah.
So we get to get into some of those topics.
Yeah.
First, though, let's set some upcoming dates.
Sure.
Per usvotefoundation.org, a website where people can go and check these election dates, because there are a number of dates that are of interest, you know, such as what's the last date you can register to vote.
Mm-hmm.
Tuesday, August 11th is the day of the Wisconsin congressional and gubernatorial primary elections.
Yep.
So Tuesday, August 11th is the date that we are kind of focusing on now. It is also the same day that absentee ballots must be returned.
Mm-hmm.
So this is important to keep in mind, because different states have different dates for that. And I think it was Louisiana was in the news because there was a kerfuffle over how they ran that, and the courts got involved. But Tuesday, August 11th, the same day as the Wisconsin primary elections, is the day that absentee ballots must be returned for that primary.
Mm-hmm.
The guest on my next show, which will probably be in June, maybe July, is a chief election inspector. And with her, we will discuss more of those issues in much greater detail. Tuesday, November 3rd, is, of course, the day of the national and state general elections. And so, as I said earlier, for a list of all election dates, please visit usvotefoundation.org. And dial into my next show, where I will cover the mechanics and processes of voting and vote tabulating and voting integrity in Wisconsin with a chief election inspector. So, Emily, we'll discuss your biography in a moment, but I want to remind our listeners how big and varied the 3rd U.S. Congressional District is.
Mm-hmm.
The 3rd encompasses all of Wisconsin's Mississippi River counties, from Pierce County in the north to Grant County in the south, including Vernon County, Viroqua. It picks up Dunn County and parts of Chippewa, Eau Claire, Jackson, Monroe, and Richland counties, and then does this interesting jog to the northeast from Juneau up to Portage.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of, or all of, 19 Wisconsin counties.
Mm-hmm.
And, Emily, that's a big area.
Yeah, very large, yes.
I was looking at it on the map the other day, and I thought, how many miles is that? So I asked AI to do some calculations for me. And so driving from the western edge of Pierce County to Portage County, then to Grant County, and then back up to Pierce is 180 road miles plus 165 plus 190 for each jog, for a total of 535 miles.
It's a lot, yes.
And if you're going to do that triangle, that mm-hmm. road trip in a day, that would be 10 hours of driving.
Mm-hmm.
So, Emily, you better get your driving gloves on.
Yeah. Oh, they've been on, yes.
I can imagine, since we've talked in October. You're going from kind of northwestern Wisconsin to central Wisconsin to southern Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly the topography changes, mm-hmm. and the towns and the cities, mm-hmm. and the municipalities and the mm-hmm. voter interests may change. But we'll get to that.
Mm-hmm.
So, Emily, tell me about yourself. What do our listeners need to know about Emily Berge?
Sure. Well, I'm just coming off of 8 years on the Eau Claire City Council. So I was elected 3 times, and my last term was as City Council President. So that means I was the highest elected official in the largest city in our district, in our vast district. So you run for that seat. So fun fact, we don't have a mayor in Eau Claire, but the City Council President is elected like a mayor. So I was on the ballot, you know, in 2023, and the City of Eau Claire elected me. And so I didn't run again for a second term as president, or it would have been a fourth term on council, because I'm going for Congress, and there's only so much a person can do. So I'm just stepping off of that 8 years of serving my community that way. I'm also a licensed professional counselor, so a therapist. Got my master's degree at Stout, actually. I've worked in all different areas. I've worked in ER rooms and with schools and businesses. I'm an outpatient. I've worked with day treatment with kids and families. And right now I'm in private practice, so that kind of allows me to scale up and down. And I've scaled down again to make sure I have enough time to drive all over the district and meet people. But that's my background is in mental health counseling, too. So I know how to, and I do, I listen to understand, not necessarily to respond, which I think politicians need to do. You know, we have two ears and one mouth for a reason, and I think we do need to listen more, and that's how good policy is formed, based on the needs of your constituents. And the other thing, too, is in my practice with counseling, it's really me empowering people to make changes in their life. And it's just what I'm doing now, and what I want to do for the constituents of the third is I want to do that at a national level, is how can I empower communities, people to make changes? I mean, I'm there to help too, but I think people forget how much power each person has and what each person can do. And if we all just do a little bit, we can create huge change. And that's what this whole campaign is about, is how can we create change? How can we do something different? Because I'm sick of the status quo, and so many people out there are sick of the status quo, and we're ready for something different. And so it's empowering people to make that happen.
Hmm. And, you know, as a counselor, so much when you talk about listening,
mm-hmm.
I'm not a mental health professional, but I do know that listening allows people to vocalize mm-hmm. What they're feeling internally. And it allows them to get it out so that they can think about maybe something that was subconscious, and they mm-hmm. can cogitate on it, if mm-hmm. you will. So it's an awesome skill to have.
Mm-hmm.
So many of us think we're good listeners, but maybe we're not. So in your tenure as Eau Claire Council President, what were some of the biggest challenges you faced?
Mm-hmm. I mean, some big challenges that actually are facing communities across the country. You know, housing is a huge one, and that, and homelessness too. But homelessness is a housing problem, just lack of supply, and then people can jack up their rents when it's just supply and demand. You know, the less housing you have, the more expensive it is. So housing. But we've done a lot at Eau Claire to make that to make changes with that. You know, in I'd like to kind of throw some numbers out that in 2020 our census in Eau Claire was 69,421, and then in 2024 ish our census was, I think, 74,039 people. So we've grown tremendously in Eau Claire.
So that's a growth of 5,000.
Yes, in about 5 years.
So what happened with the housing?
So the housing, so our vacancy rate in about 2021 was around 1%. And you need a vacancy rate between 5 and 8% to have affordable housing. And then as of, I think, 2 years ago, vacancy rate grew. So that's good because there's more room. It grew to about, 4%, 3 or 4%. So despite this tremendous growth that Eau Claire has seen, we are keeping up with the housing needs, even surpassing it because the vacancy rate has gone up, so there's more room in our housing, which means prices will come down. And so I think that just shows you it's a complex problem, housing, but it's a good problem that we're growing too. We just have those growing pains, and we're one of the few areas in the states that is growing, actually, because the state of Wisconsin is slated to lose, I believe, like 200,000 people in the next 30 years, but the city of Eau Claire is projected to grow by about 12%. So the state is losing people, you know, the city of Eau Claire and the Chippewa Valley is aiming to grow, like we're on the trajectory to grow. And so again, with that comes some growing pains, but I think at the policies that we have put into place, like our housing policies. Another thing too is I've been very strong as city council president to say that all are welcome in Eau Claire because people want to live at a place where people are welcome. You know, it's not only the ethical thing to do to say that, you know, all are welcome, but it's economically it makes sense as well.
So let me unpack some of what you just went through. First of all, I do remember reading the data on the population data and projections from the state of Wisconsin. And my numbers probably aren't as fresh as yours, but I do remember reading that the state of Wisconsin is going to lose about 3% of its population over the next 5 to 10 years, something like that. Mm-hmm. And that probably equates to 200,000. And I gather that has to do with our overall lower birth rate?
Yep. Okay. Well, and yeah, our death rate is increased. If it's not suppressed, our birth rate, it will be, right, yep.
And so, but the statistics also pointed out to, well, 30 or more counties, probably way more than that in Wisconsin, are going to lose population. There was like 3 or 4 counties that were going to increase in population. And so how did Eau Claire increase, what were some of the things that Eau Claire did to increase the housing availability? Because this is a big component of costs of our, you know, what's gobbling up our income, and the cost of living is increasing because the cost of housing is increasing. So what did Eau Claire do?
So over the last, and it takes a long time, but over the last 8 years I served on the council, you know, we even started with, part of it is having community conversations around housing too, and making sure that people understand what's going on. And so when I was first elected in 2018, we had Affordable Housing Task Force where we brought everyone together, and we had developers there, we had elected officials there, and we met as a community to have those conversations. We also had a grassroots group that was at the forefront of having these conversations. So that's part of it. And then through that kind of policy ideas came out of, which then we used to start, you know, checking off our list. But a huge thing that we did was redid our zoning code. So we hadn't redone our zoning code in, I think, 100 years. I mean, it was really, and zoning is a very arbitrary, there's just arbitrary lines.
Right. So there's a certain amount of opaqueness here, because what you are effectively saying is that in order to increase housing, you had to build new housing. Or that's, additional housing, correct?
That's part of it, yep.
Or renovate housing or convert existing properties. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
And so the codes that you're talking about, building codes, zoning would factor directly into that, because people, you know, in our soundbite nature, we get 5 or 6, 7 second soundbites, and you say, well, we're going to need to add more or increase affordable housing. Well, it gets down to the details. How do you do that, right? So a developer somewhere is in the mix, because someone's got to put hammers on a piece of lumber and start building or changing something. So I interrupted. Yep. Keep going.
Yes. So it's break down. So it's good to have them at the table, because what do they need to have affordable housing? So one changes that we made to our zoning code is we now allow ADUs, so accessory dwelling units, which again, it used to, like, they're like the granny flats or, you know, above garages where there's apartments. A lot of municipalities, those are illegal, and they were in Eau Claire before we changed it. So it's allowing to have those that density and to build those, whether it's attached to your home or, you know, standalone. So, yeah, so ADU, so now those are allowed in the zoning.
So 60 Minutes, I don't know if you watched them,
no.
But last night,
they
did a spot on ADUs.
Oh, there you go.
And they were focused on Los Angeles or Palisades, where they had the fire.
Yeah.
And the construction they're way, way behind on all their building permits.
Yeah.
I'm going to get the numbers wrong, but it was something like 80,000 building permits were outstanding for that area.
Mm-hmm.
And so just people were kind of shoehorning their ADUs on their property just to help other people.
Mm-hmm.
And you can develop a pretty efficient, what did you call it? It's adult?
Accessory dwelling unit.
Accessory dwelling unit. Okay, so that's one tool, I suppose,
yep,
in the housing tool bag.
And so it's important, again, that a lot of zoning codes, you cannot do that. And so that's why it requires the policymakers of your city or town or county to make those legal. So making sure that, we can do we have these ideas, but we have to make sure that we can do it. And streamlining the permitting process, that's something else. So with the ARPA dollars, I don't know if you remember that came from the federal government after COVID. So the good thing about that, which is very fortunate, which I would tend to do, and I'm in Congress too, is to work more efficiently with local communities. But that ARPA dollars, they went directly to local communities. And so they didn't have to bypass through the state. Then the state decides what they think is best for local communities. So we get to decide what we want to do with our ARPA dollars. And we use it to redo our zoning. We use it to help with more inspections so we can speed up the permitting process, like what they're seeing in California. So again, like local communities know how to spend that money. And for us, housing was such a priority that we use it to, fast track those housing initiatives. And then that helps us, increase that vacancy rate. So then it increases more affordable housing rates too.
Well, and by the way, the greater the housing you have, the improved tax base.
Yeah.
So you get people in there paying property taxes,
mm-hmm,
either a landlord or the owner. I mean, and that is good for the city one way or the other. So the speaking of dollars and funding for in and around Eau Claire, the last time we spoke, there was an issue. You had an issue with Derek Van Orden, and who is the incumbent representative for the 3rd District. And he was at the time sponsoring a bill to cancel $2 million worth of funding for the city of Eau Claire. How did that ever turn out?
Shocking. It didn't go anywhere, And I don't know if so he was on the news, I don't know if it was before or after that, talking about how he wanted to defund the city of Eau Claire because he didn't like what a couple council members said. And I went on right after him and said, you cannot use your political privilege to punish people, that's not how you're supposed to be a representative. So he actually went away after that and didn't really say much. I was a part of a protest in front of City Hall. And then he went to go threaten the Mayo Clinic and pull their funding for some of the same reason. And then it kind of, he says big things, makes a big fuss, and then he kind of goes away. But you have to stand up to him. Like, I stood up to him and said, no, you can't do that. That's not what, you shouldn't use your political privilege to punish your constituents. And so he just went after the Mayo Clinic then. And then it just went away, and I haven't heard anything more. So that bill was that he wanted to defund, like if anyone said anything, which is completely against the First Amendment rights, like that they could take away federal dollars if they didn't like what someone said, in their district, which is just...
Right, well, you don't have to search very far to find verbiage or rhetoric on both sides that is highly inflammatory. And it's like, excuse me?
Yeah, right? I agree with that. That's not how I lead either. I'm very much about honesty and telling. Like, I'll tell it how it is, but I'm not going to make things up.
Right. So, Emily, in traversing the 535 miles in your triangular road trip across the 3rd District, What are let's pick a number, the top five topics that you've been hearing from us, the voters, when you meet with us face to face and you have a chance to listen, what are they?
Yeah, top five. Well, number one is healthcare. I mean, that's like everyone throughout the district talks about healthcare and everyone knows it's not working. And people, especially...
I wrote that one down.
Okay,
so
then
got
I keep going. Okay, healthcare.
We're going to get to that. What's the next one?
Big money out of politics. People are sick and tired of that.
Okay, so was just reading an article today about how the new super PACs, funded by various technology giants, Meta and others, are funding their various causes, and they're dumping, I think in this coming election cycle, something like $210 million into local races to fund, for example, online gaming, data centers is a big one, pumping big dollars into local races to propagate whatever their profitable agenda is. So I get that one. So we'll talk a little bit more about that. So we got healthcare, big money in politics. What are what are three more?
Education comes up a lot.
Education, okay.
Especially, you know, it's a very rural district, and education is really big. Main Street, like downtown businesses, that comes up. Small businesses come up a lot, and just the struggle that a lot of small businesses face. Oh, and then agriculture, you know, farming communities. I talk to a lot of farmers, small and medium-sized farms that are struggling as well. Just people are struggling, you know, just having a hard time. So, is that five?
It depends on if you're combining Main Street and agriculture together.
Okay. No, well, how many are... Those are probably two different ones, but I will add in housing, too.
Housing, all right. So we're going to add housing to that. Now, before we get into those, let me do a channel check, reminding our listeners that my name is Frank Dravis, and I'm your conversations host this morning. You are listening to WDRT 91.9 FM in Viroqua, and today my guest is Emily Berge, Democratic candidate for the U.S. 3rd Congressional District of Wisconsin. Okay, so let's delve into some of those topics that you brought up. Let's try education first. What have you been hearing specifically about education? And it's interesting to me, my kids would go to the DeSoto School District, and it's a very long and narrow school district here in western Wisconsin, and we're losing children. I mean, the population is slowly declining, slowly, and the schools in the DeSoto School District are getting fewer and fewer kids. They're facing funding challenges. They're facing referendum challenges. They're just not that many kids there. So, but that's a very local education issue. So what are you hearing?
Just what you just said, I hear that a lot, that people are worried about their, again, it's a lot of rural, but also, you know, Eau Claire, the largest city in the district, same, there's a lot of concerns there too about public education. And it really comes down, the main thing right now is voucher schools, so that, you know, money is taken. Now it's a state issue, but they are trying to do this at the national level, so they're trying. But so they take, the state legislature, I think in 2016-ish, they made a law that they will take money out of the general fund and put it to state-mandated voucher schools. Well, 2 years later, the next budget they passed, they said, nope, no more out of the general fund. We're going to take it out of your local property tax. So the money, and I don't know how much money like Viroqua schools get, but like that money you get from the state, the Viroqua schools get, they get so many, I don't know how much, we can look online and see how much, but in Eau Claire, it's about $4 million comes from the local tax base that is supposed to go to the local schools, and it goes to voucher programs. And so that means that, so that state voucher, state mandated voucher program. So those are private schools. And this is nothing against private schools at all. If parents want to, you know, send their kids to private schools, that's fine. But I believe that public dollars should go to public schools. And so, because that's taken away money away from our local schools, which then causes them to lose staffing. They can't keep up with repairs, and it causes them to eventually close or consolidate.
So I completely agree this is a state issue. How would you see the representative from the 3rd Congressional District getting involved in this?
It's talking about it, and I think it shows that I am an advocate of public education talking about it, because it still does impact our local communities. And I'll answer your question in a second, but I want to say, as city council president, I offered a resolution in front of council that, so now on our tax bills, it will say in November and December, actually, how much of our money, our local property taxes, go to state-mandated voucher schools, so a tax transparency. And so I just talking about it, and a lot of people don't know that our public dollars is going to private schools, and our local public schools are suffering because of it. So talking about it, using that platform, I think is really important. But like I said, they are trying to do this at the national level. I mean, right now, they're baby-stepping their way by starting to do like tax credits. But Trump has offered that and talking about that, you know, in his national policy. And so they're trying. So often they've used, I think, Wisconsin as a test case, because with, you know, they had Scott Walker and they had the Republican legislature, the way that they decimated, you know, unions with Act 10. And now they're trying to do that, you know, nationwide. This education system is the same thing. So there's this voucher program that they're doing at the state level, they're trying to do at the national level, because they see it's working. It's making our public schools crumble, because they are taking money from our public schools and pointing them to private schools, which do not have to serve the same kids, and they don't have to follow the same rules and parameters, and they don't have the same oversight as public schools do. You know, public schools, like, we elect the school board, right? They answer to the public because it's tax dollars. Private schools, they don't answer to the school board. They answer to some, I don't even know what they answer to. Some rich businessman, probably, you know, like, so they like that. It's a whole privatization that our country is on, and they're using in Wisconsin, they're trying to do it, and they have been successful at crumbling our public schools, and they want to do it at the national level. And so I will do everything I can to prevent that from happening, because that is un-American. I mean, education is the basis of our democracy, and free and public education, right? Everyone needs to be able to access education. But with schools closing, like, that makes it harder and harder for kids to do.
Okay, very interesting. Another topic you brought up was healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
Your district is very rural. A concern is the district and the quality of medical treatment the residents have to, you know, how far they have to travel to reach or attain that treatment. What are the, you know, it seems to me that education, public education, and access to health care are related.
Mm-hmm.
At least philosophically, in having equal availability, equal treatment. So what are you hearing from your residents in terms of healthcare?
Well, again, you said it, you hit the nail on the head, that people are having trouble even getting to healthcare, whether it be their, you know, primary, what's it called? You know, like just your doctor, you know, or if you're pregnant, you know, labor and delivery departments are closing throughout the whole district. Menominee closed, Barron closed. No, Barron's outside of the district, but it impacts people in the district. So people have to drive further and further. You look at...
As, you know, being a mental health professional with a private practice, I think you're probably uniquely positioned to, with visibility into, you know, the
yes.
payment system, how these people are, where they're getting their money from, and how much money they have to pay for treatment.
Yeah.
What has been, with the funding of the Big Beautiful Bill and the decrease in Medicaid payments, which I gather was due to be factored in over a certain period of time, where are we with that evolution, that decrease in payments? Because it was my understanding that it wasn't going to happen all at once,
mm-hmm.
which was smart for the people who passed the bill, because they didn't want it to hit all at once
mm-hmm.
and cause this groundswell of opposition, but here we are. The elections are coming up in November, mm-hmm. so where are we with the result of that?
Yeah, and I think you're right. That's going to take longer to. Longer to see because Medicaid payments go more to like day treatment areas or hospitals, and it's going to take longer to trickle down. But what people have felt right away is the expiration of the ACA tax credits that the Republicans did nothing about at the end of the year. And so I heard from numerous people that were already paying, a lot of farmers too, and small business owners were paying maybe $500 a month for their health insurance, you know, on the market with, you know, the ACA. That went up $1,500 a month. So from, and then just for it to hit your budget just like that. So you're paying $500 a month. Now you're paying $1,500 a month. And again, people, and these are, I've already heard that young people were going without health insurance, but these are like moms with kids who messaged me saying that they're now going out without health insurance and they're just going to like hope for the best. You know, this is why we need Medicare for all. Like, why are we playing these games with people? You know, like why should a mom who's got two kids have to go without health insurance and just hope for the best? We're the richest country in the world and we can't provide health care to our citizens and residents. Like, that's ridiculous and it's harmful. And it's like education. It's undemocratic because people that are not, like, we need health care to live our best lives. You know, we can't go, people are going bankrupt because this mom and her kid, if her kid gets into a bike accident and he's in the ER, has to get airlifted. Someone was just telling me that, where was he, in Rapids, and he got airlifted to Marshfield and it cost like $33,000 for that trip. Now he's on Medicare, so he didn't have to pay for that, or it was maybe a couple hundred dollars, but someone without health insurance, who's going to pay for that? So yeah, there definitely is a link between just being able to live a good life that you're not bankrupt by healthcare. You shouldn't have to have fundraisers to pay for cancer treatments. So this is why Medicare for All, which will also stabilize our rural hospitals too, you know, and making sure that they stay open and the doors stay open and that there are, you know, you wonder why rural America and rural Wisconsin is losing population. It's because there's not hospitals nearby. There's no place to have a baby, even if a woman wants to have a baby. You know, if you have a heart attack, like, it's going to take an ambulance because it's going to be volunteer because of local municipal funding, which is a whole other topic. But it's going to take an ambulance a half hour to get to you. And then it's going to take another probably 45 minutes to get you to the hospital. So at that, when you're having a stroke or a heart attack, every minute counts. And so people realize that and they're moving away from rural America. But if we actually had funded health care, people could stay. They could stay on the farm and they could stay, you know, where they want to live in rural Wisconsin and get the health care they need, mental health care as well.
So the published mortality rates across the world, there are a number of countries that have better mortality rates than the U.S. I don't even know if our longevity per person is in the top 10. I don't know, but I know it's not in the top 3. So eventually these mortality statistics are going to begin to reflect the impact of payments for these people to achieve better health care because their mortality rates are going to increase. When you make a decision to not get insurance, and if you don't have insurance and you get sick and you say, well, I can't go to the hospital, I'm just going to grunt my way through mm-hmm. it so I don't get a medical bill, well, that's a decision that over the grand scheme of things, over the long run, over the population, you're going to see higher mortality rates, and that will begin to come out in the scores for the countries. Mm-hmm. It's early yet, but we will see that.
Mm-hmm. It's also more expensive because they might eventually show up in the ER, and if they don't have insurance, you know, ERs can't turn people away.
So that's a very good point because the rates, if you have insurance, what the rate that you pay is a negotiated rate for your service.
Right.
And so if you go into the ER, you're paying retail, the retail rate that the hospital will charge. Whereas if you go in with insurance, you're paying the rate on those services that the insurance company negotiated
That's
with the
true.
Hospital. And it's less.
Oh, I know. As a provider, I see that all the time. Yeah, the insurance companies will say, this is how much we'll pay you. And they undercut services all the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, you know, even if you have a higher deductible, you still benefit from having the insurance rate rather than the hospital retail rate. So you have, listening to you, Emily, it's like there's this double whammy against rural America. Mm-hmm. One is you have young families raising children, and they're looking at it, well, where do I want to send my kids to school? And they look at, well, what's the local school district like? You know, whether they're raising their families in Viroqua or DeSoto or Romance or wherever, they're going to look at and say, well, we have a chance to pick where our new house is going to be or where we're going to move to. I don't think I really like the school district. There's not a lot of kids there. It's kind of declining. And so there's this impetus for them to move to an area that has a greater school district, a better school district, more people in it. And then you have the threat of healthcare about what hospitals are nearby, what is the quality of service, what's the quality of treatment. And so those two factors or vectors, if you will, are kind of impacting where people want to live, and those are two factors against moving to rural areas. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love living in a rural area myself, and I know people are moving to the Viroqua area, mm-hmm. but I don't know what their individual demographics are.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing you talked about that you've been hearing from is your constituents is Main Street businesses. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that.
So I hear that a lot, that they're just struggling so much. And again, it's these smaller communities in a city like Eau Claire, where it's, you know, you have 74,000 people. Like, you can, you know, a business closes, which is sad. You know, you never want to see a local business close, but Eau Claire can like absorb it, and then usually someone will come in and open a new business. If you look at like a downtown business in Viroqua or Livingston, you know, like, you feel that when one business closed, you feel it. And so that's what I'm hearing, that people are just, they're sad to see their downtowns. They feel like they're kind of dying, and that people just drive through, you know, like these busy highways, just people just keep going and they don't stop. But it's really, you look at economic development. So you brought up data centers. So what I think about, so the state legislature, the state, they gave data centers a $2 billion tax credit for economic development. However, if you took that $2 billion and invested it into local communities, you would see way more economic development. Like, if you could allow local municipalities to do like revolving loan fund, you know, and have these businesses that want to start a business, like help them get off the ground with a loan or a revolving loan fund, so then they pay it back in the fund. You know, that's something that we can do in Eau Claire, but other municipalities can do it. But right now, again, this is more of a state issue, but I do think the federal government can help in this regard. But the state government has defunded local communities so much that we like are just trying to make sure that the roads are paved, and that when you call 911 that someone shows up, and there's not a lot left over to invest in our local businesses and, you know, help them get off the ground, so, or just help them stay open. The other thing too is it's all put together, like, to, we need people to live in rural Wisconsin to shop at these local businesses. So again, healthcare, like you're saying, education, good jobs that pay well, like all those things are what tracks people. Housing, you know.
I wanted to talk about this a little bit later, but since we kind of diverted into it, the topic about AI data centers, a lot is, you know, you've got examples like Port Washington, Beaver Dam, Mount Pleasant. These are cities in towns and municipalities in Wisconsin where there are battles going on around data center development, data center placement. You know, and they talk about billions of dollars to put up a data center. The actual employment of a data center, and I'm a former chief information officer. I had my own data center. It was a small one. We had cloud services. So I happen to know a little bit about this subject. Data centers are intensive in water consumption, and so they're obviously intensive in power consumption. And they're not particular, and the people who build the data centers pride themselves in making them lights out. And that means doesn't need any people to run them, or very few people. So the question becomes, how do you balance the local need of the municipality? I believe there is the opportunity to regulate what a data center should have in it. Because if the data center, it costs a little bit more, well, I don't want to say a little bit more money, but it costs more money for a data center to have closed-loop cooling.
Yes. That's, yeah.
A lot of data center developers don't want to do that. They mm-hmm. want to use the groundwater because it's cheaper. Well, guess what happens at a water table?
Mm-hmm.
Where are they going to put this water after they used it, you know, since it's not a closed-loop system?
Mm-hmm.
The power, a lot of the data centers, you know, data center developers don't want to put power generation on site because then, again, it increased their cost. They would rather just pull it from the grid, which increases the public generation costs. And so the federal government does have a role here, and it comes in the form of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. A dirty little secret about these data centers is if they don't have on-site power generation, they got to pull it from the grid, which means the line companies that route the electricity or the power generation companies start rubbing their hands together and say, oh boy, we get to put in a much larger power line. And there is a debate going on right now here in the mm-hmm. 3rd Congressional.
I've heard about it, yes.
Yeah, the Maribel Project, mm-hmm. the 765K project, where they're routing, mm-hmm. they want to bring in somewhere between 200 to 280 foot tall towers from Maribel, from a place in Minnesota all the way to central Wisconsin, and there are two proposed routes. Well, they're using eminent domain. They want to use eminent domain to bring these power lines through the mm-hmm. properties, and it will basically destroy the certain land tracts that the power lines come through. This is a byproduct of those data centers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I believe there is a role, because this is going to, every state's going to be different, right? And so I'm just wondering, running for the 3rd Congressional District, what do you think is the role for the federal government in at least organizing or proposing standardized data center development?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think regulation. I mean, like you said, like, we can require a closed loop system so that they're essentially putting straws in our groundwater and sucking up our groundwater. So a closed loop system that doesn't use, you know, water, a lot of water. And in fact, and, you know, Trane and LaCrosse, they make these, manufacture these as well. So double bonus if data centers do use those. But it's about having regulation to make sure that, yeah, and energy, making sure that if they do require jobs to build the data center, so using union labor to do it. But
that's transient. That's short term.
Yeah. The unions still are in favor. I mean, yes, I'm just saying, like, unions are in favor, though, of having union jobs, which makes sense, you know. But no, but having regulations and, like you're saying, having that local control. I was just talking to a huge...
Hang on for a second. I need to do a channel check.
Oh, yeah.
Just want to remind our listeners today that my name is Frank Dravis, your conversations host, and you are listening to WDRT 91.9 FM in Viroqua. And today my guest is Emily Berge, Democratic candidate for the U.S. 3rd Congressional District of Wisconsin. So go ahead, Emily.
So federal regulations, certainly, I think local control. I was talking to someone up in Menominee who was really against the data center that was going up there. Now that's been, I think, put on pause. But it was refreshing to me because he understood, like, he's against these huge data centers and he's and how they can just plop down if you don't have regulations, like a lot of in like unzoned areas in the county, they can just come in against the will of the people and like, and that's not okay. Like people should say, but he understood the big picture that again, the state government has defunded local municipalities so much. And so not that I agree, but I understand when this big company comes in and says, we're going to, and they entice these local officials who are just regular people who want the best for their community with all this, like we will increase your tax base. It doesn't require a lot. Cause like you say, it doesn't require a lot of infrastructure cause they'll come in and build it. He understood why we're, and then plus the state is like, goes back to that. The state has incentivized data centers to come here while defunding local communities. And so we're setting up this huge perfect storm of data centers to come in and take over, you know, because we're rewarding these data centers to come in while starving local municipalities that put them in these impossible situations. Now, they should always be able to say no. But again, like it's this whole setup, by the way, what policies are being passed at the state level, which we can fix at the federal level if we actually can help local communities thrive and not have to be reliant on these big tech companies to come in.
Right. So I'm all for, and I'm a big advocate of America being competitive. And I'm very in favor of the common or ordinary citizen being able to tap into AI to improve their lives, right? I mean, if there's a person who's sick and they don't know what's bothering them and they should be able to do some sort of AI search before they call their hospital and try and get educated before, if they have that opportunity. So I'm all for the local populace having access to AI. And that means data centers, but I'm also for a sane way of building these data centers up with the approval of the local municipalities, because there's a right way to do it, mm-hmm. and then there's the Cadillac way to mm-hmm. do it, where you just have sprawling 500-acre mm-hmm. implementations. Mm-hmm. You don't need 500 right. acres mm-hmm. to put up a data center. Mm-hmm. That's the lazy way of doing it.
Right.
You do the right thing for the local area. Put in your own power generation, but
yeah,
I've talked about that.
And so that's why we need to have local people sit at these tables when they're deciding these policy too.
So yeah. We've got about 15 minutes left. Big money. Mm-hmm. You brought up big money. Tell me about big money.
Well, and that's a great. Well, we're transitioning to that because I want to actually loop back. So right now, like you're talking about these tech people and. In Silicon Valley in California, like AI people, crypto people, they are buying up politicians right now because they do see it. Regulations are going to come down, or they're going to pressure to not do regulations like what's happening now, and we need regulations at the federal level. But right now, all these companies, AI companies and whatnot, are buying politicians, and they're like, I have emails in my inbox offering me to like fund my campaign. Like if they are doing, and now I have ethics, so I'm not going to go down that road. And for me, it's more about the people than the money. And, you know, campaigns do need money, but it's important to know that that's happening right now. And so we do need to get money out of politics. You know, that's overturning Citizens United. You know, companies are not people. They don't get the same free speech protections as a human does. You know, it's looking at, it's making sure, you know, incentivize, this is kind of similar but different, but incentivizing, right now people can go to Congress and they can, you know, trade stocks and they can get all that insider information and they, you know, sell and buy stocks depending on that and they get insanely rich. So we have to ban, you know, individual stock trading in Congress.
Well, that's like a no-brainer.
Yeah, well, you would think.
Yep.
Yes. And I would, yeah. And then also, and Elizabeth Warren actually just proposed legislation on this, but to close that revolving door between Congress and becoming a lobbyist as well. Because so people get into Congress, trade a bunch of stocks, get rich, then they quit Congress, then become a lobbyist and get even more richer because they're then a lobbyist for AI companies. And then they use their relationships, you know, in Congress. So we have to put an end to that as well. So that all goes into getting big money out of politics with overturning Citizens United, actually funding the FEC and giving them the teeth that so they can be a guard dog.
So was that, did you say the SEC?
FEC, sorry.
FEC, and that is?
Like the organization at the national level that, you know, oversees the financial reports and things like that.
Oh, for the election.
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
As you move around your district, what are you hearing from our farmers? We know about the price of diesel now.
Yeah.
We know President Trump went to China to try and negotiate a deal with the Chinese to buy more soybeans. What are our farmers? Now, you've already talked briefly about the cost of health care mm-hmm. and how the price of the ACA coverage definitely increased for our farmers. What are you hearing from them? How are they feeling? What's it like for them?
Yeah, they feel alone. They feel left behind. They feel like no one cares about them. And you look at the input costs, like fertilizer. I mean, diesel, yes, but fertilizer is through the roof. And so,
who knew some insane amount of our fertilizer came through the Straits of Hormuz?
Yeah, right.
Like 80% is something stupid.
Yeah, yeah. So I was talking to a farmer in Trumbull County, and he didn't buy his fertilizer in October, you know, when he was kind of planning. So then now he's looking, and this was probably 6 weeks ago, and it's just gotten worse. And he's like talking to the bank about his options, and he might have to sell his farm because he can't afford it anymore. So it's just the cost of fertilizer alone is just, I mean, the margins are so narrow and they're just scraping by, and it doesn't have to be like that. So yeah, farmers just want, they just want to be able to farm. It's a lifestyle, you know, to live in rural Wisconsin and to live in the beautiful countryside and, you know, you work hard out in the field and fixing fences and even getting up at 2 a.m. to milk cows. They grew up that way a lot, and they want to continue that for their kids, and it's getting more and more impossible for that to happen, and they can't afford it. And same with, like, their kids. Their kids may want to get into farming, but they don't think they can afford it. Or maybe their kids don't want to get into farming, but someone does want to get into farming, and there's no, like, plan for that to make happen either, because land prices have gone through the roof because these AI data centers are coming in to jacking up these land prices to make it out of reach for just regular people to afford land to farm. So that's another thing I hear too, is just the land prices are through the roof.
So and then there's the price of diesel. I, Emily, I get depressed when I think about this, because I don't see how the price of diesel is going to come down anytime soon. Because the Iranians, I mean, they, by simple math, the Iranians were making $43 billion, somewhere between $43 and $50 billion a year in income and in revenue before the war. That doesn't mean profit. That's revenue. And now the Iranians want to charge every ship that goes through mm-hmm. the Straits of Hormuz $2 million.
Yeah.
And so Bloomberg did the math on this and tracking, and that's worth $50 billion a year to the Iranians. They're not going to give that up.
No.
And so I don't see the price of diesel fuel coming down anytime soon, unless there is some movement at the national level to incentivize refiners to create more diesel fuel for our truckers and our farmers. That's a national thing. That's not a state thing. And I think we're stuck with diesel unless something happens at the national level. So we have 5 minutes left.
Okay.
And as usual, we have spent a lot of time talking about some very good things, and we haven't gotten near half of the things I wanted to talk about. But I did kind of want to recap before we close, before I give you the last bit of mentioning what we may have passed up on, but so many things have happened since we last spoke.
Yeah.
And just in terms of federal government actions and what a member of Congress would be interested in, there was the government shutdown and then reopening. There were the ICE raids in Minneapolis, mm-hmm. Portland, and Chicago. There was a Supreme Court struck down the IEEPA tariffs, would hope would have helped our small business and farmers in some indirect way. There was the partial shutdown of the Department of Homeland Security, and then it reopened. There was the raid on Venezuela and the arrest of Nicolas Maduro. There was the second bombing of Iran, which closed the Straits of Hormuz. And back in October, when we last spoke, the average price of gasoline was $2.74, and now it's $4.55. Those were the good old days.
Mm-hmm.
So, with that, what are the closing comments that you'd like to make?
Well, it seems like things are getting worse, not better. And I think people are feeling that out there, and I hear about it all the time. Like, my campaign is showing up where people are at in their local communities, and listening to what you said. People talk about it, whether it be terrorizing our immigrant communities, whether it's price of gas through the roof, the tariffs. In fact, Wonder State, the owner of Wonder State, was on the radio talking about that. You know, these impact, and now we're supposed to get money back, but no one knows the plan for that, you know. And the big corporations, they have a plan because they have all the attorneys to figure it out. But the local businesses, once again, they had to figure that out. So people are feeling all of those. I mean, it might seem really big, these federal policies, but they impact us at the local level every single day. They impact our neighbors, they impact our businesses, our families. And that's why I'm running my campaign the way I'm doing, is I'm showing up everywhere. And I have built a grassroots movement of people. If I can just share, I know we have 2 minutes left, but you need 1,000 signatures to get on the ballot for the congressional camp for Congress. Within the first day, we collected about 500 signatures. Within 5 days, we got over 1,300 signatures to get on the ballot. And that was over 40 plus volunteers for the campaign gathered those signatures in every county in the district, so every 19 counties. So that just shows you what we have built, this movement of showing up in local communities. That's people talking to their neighbors about getting me on the ballot and how I can serve them in Congress. And that's what we need to do. Our federal elected people need to pay attention to what's going on the ground, and I am committed to that.
Hmm. Very nice. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So I like to close our show today and let everyone know that my name is Frank Dravis, your conversations host, and I think people have learned from you, Emily Berge, candidate for the 3rd Congressional District of Wisconsin, about some of the issues that we're facing, what your positions are, and I very much want to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks.
Thank you very much. And with that, my name is Frank Dravis, Conversations host for WDRT 91.9 FM in Viroqua, Wisconsin.